Hey, superhero fans, this is Rick Cosnett, Eddie Thorne from The Flash, and you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to all my fellow geeks and nerds out there in podcast land. This is Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. Yet another fantastic conversation lined up for you folks today. Now, you guys and gals, you know out there, I love the CW series, The Flash. Today, I'll be sitting down with the man who made the ultimate sacrifice in season one of The Flash. We've seen him make brief returns to the show in recent years. Will he be making a big return in a sinister way? Who knows? That's one of the things I'll be talking about with the amazing actor Rick Cosnett. Rick played Eddie Thorne in season one. We are going to be chatting about his time in Central City. So much more to chat about with Rick today. That conversation coming at you in just a few moments. Now, before we hear from Rick, a few things I want to mention to all you folks out there, and these are some things you might be interested in. First, part two of my IndieCast get-together with Laird Malamed and Ron Longo is now online. Now, if you heard part one, you know what this is all about, but Laird, Ron, and myself, we sat down. We talked a lot about John Williams. Those two have put together a bunch of John Williams specials, but I got to join him right now. We specifically talked about the Maestro's score to the film Superman the Movie. 40th anniversary for the Super Flick this year. You know I've been celebrating all year long so far. Now, Laird edited our chat into two parts. We talked a lot about the score for Superman the Movie, the sequels that came after it, the music, how the music influenced it, Superman Returns. We talked about a lot of different things. Part two is now online. You can check it out at theindiecast.com.
Tune in each fortnight to the IndieCast, the world's number one Indiana Jones fan podcast.
Trust me.
Featuring the latest news, reviews, and interviews with on-screen and behind-the-scenes talent who helped bring to life the greatest adventure movie series ever made. Each episode has the latest from the world of Indiana Jones, as well as interactive segments, trivia, contests, and specials, including radio dramas and music retrospectives. The IndieCast.
It's a transmitter. It's a radio for speaking to God.
Available in iTunes or listen directly at theindiecast.com.
If adventure has a name, it must be The IndieCast.
Now, I'll put the link to The IndieCast in the show notes for this episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net, as well as the show notes on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/comicbookcentral. I'm going to mention a few things coming up here. So links to everything I'm talking about, you're going to hear it. You're going to hear them now, but no need to write them down. If you just check out comicbookcentral.net, the show notes, or blogtalkradio.com/comicbookcentral. If you're, well, you're already following there, right? If you're there, you're going to have access to everything you need. So those links will be there. Speaking of the Maestro, last week, I mentioned this on the show, John Williams himself, he conducted the Cleveland Orchestra. As you would imagine, it was one of the greatest nights ever. I was there. It was epic. Close Encounters, E.T., Jaws, Raiders of the Lost Ark, of course, his revised composition for Han Solo and Princess Leia. He revised that theme. He plays it now. The Imperial March showed up. Some other music, too, I wasn't expecting. Sabrina, Lincoln, Hook, a bunch of things. So I've said this on social media. For those of us that grew up listening to this music, that grew up in the late 70s, early 80s, those films, and we've enjoyed each of his soundtracks since then, man, when you go to see this, it's just like watching your life being played back in front of you. It's amazing. These films and the music mean so much to us. Unbelievable night. I've seen him conduct orchestras four times now. I don't know how he does it. He keeps getting better with age. It's just unbelievable. I was hoping that since he was in Cleveland, since it's the 80th anniversary of Superman, it's the 40th anniversary of his score to Superman the movie, I was hoping we might hear the Superman theme. We didn't. Look, no complaints at all. I've heard it other times in concert. So the Cleveland Orchestra, simply incredible. If you have a chance to check them out, please do. Third time seeing them for me. First two times you've heard them here on the show. Raiders of the Lost Ark with the orchestra playing to the film. Superman at the Symphony. Also September and October of 2016. I did some interviews leading up to those events. You can check out those episodes at Comic Book Central. I interviewed conductor Brett Mitchell and others. So That was fun. The orchestra is amazing. I mention this now because coming up Friday, August 31st, Star Wars in concert. Man, that is going to be amazing. Talk about John Williams music being played by the Cleveland Orchestra. Man, they're going to be doing it just like they did with Raiders of the Lost Ark. They're going to be doing the same thing with Star Wars. I've been waiting for this thing. Conductor Brett Mitchell, he mentioned he would love to do that. He's in Colorado now, but maybe he'll get to do it in Colorado. But Cleveland Orchestra is doing it coming up August 31st. So clevelandorchestra.com, that's where you go to find out more and to order tickets. It's going to be amazing. I'm going to be there. I'm working on interviews for that show leading up to it as well. So stay tuned to Comic Book Central. You're going to be hearing more about that. Also, something else you're going to be hearing more about. More John Williams goodness. John Williams all over the place. Man, if you love John Williams, check him out this summer. He's appearing in a bunch of places. But the maestro himself, he's going to be at the summer home of the Boston Pops this year, Tanglewood, Saturday, August the 11th. It's going to be film night. I'll be there. I'm working on some interviews in advance of that show, too. I can't promise the maestro. I can't promise he's going to be showing up here in Comic Book Central. That'd be awesome. His schedule is unbelievably busy, but rest assured, I am working on it. So if it happens, you're going to hear it here. We'll see what works out. Long shot, but we'll see. BSO, that's Boston Symphony Orchestra, BSO.org. That's where you go for more information and tickets at that site. Again, website, comicbookcentral.net, blogtalkradio.com/comicbookcentral. All these links are going to be in there. So check them out. Man, I'm telling you what, it's going to be a busy summer. I'm going to bring you as much of it as I can here on Comic Book Central with a lot going on this year. One other news note I want to mention. Since my guest this week, it seems appropriate, is from the world of The Flash, you've probably heard the catchphrase on the show so many times, run, Barry, run. One catchphrase you might not be familiar with, though, is run, Laird, run. That is the website of my buddy and fellow IndieCast podcaster, the aforementioned, the amazing Laird Malamed. His website is runlairdrun.com. Now, not only is Laird a fantastic podcaster, not only is he an extremely successful businessman, he is a marathon man. He has run marathons in all 50 states, all 7 continents. That's like staggering. I can't even imagine that. He's going to be hitting 20,000 miles this week. That's unbelievable. To talk about a Fitbit, man, that thing's going to explode. He is running in the Boston Marathon on April 16th. He's got Star Wars races in Orlando, April 20th through the 22nd. Now, you can support him. Here's like while he's running, he's raising money for charity as well. So if you'd like to know more and how you can contribute, every donation to Children International, it's doubled. Check out the website, Run Laird Run. It's LAIRD. So runlairdrun.com. Check that out. You can find out everything you need to know there. Congrats to my buddy Laird. I love what he does on the podcast. But man, what he's doing, raising money and doing all these things, it's just unbelievable. He just keeps setting the bar higher and higher. So congrats, Laird. Good on you. All right. Busy summer. Lots going on. Lots going on here in the Lair today. Check this out. Get a little more background on my special guest today, and then you will be hearing from Rick Cosnett. If you watch the TV series The Flash, you might think that Rick was born and raised right here in the States, but that is just how good of an actor he is. Rick was actually born and raised in Zimbabwe before eventually moving to Australia and ultimately the United States, where he landed television roles on shows like Heartland and The Vampire Diaries. In 2014, he was cast into the comic book world on the CW series The Flash. Rick landed the role of police detective Eddie Thawne, and all of us hardcore comic book fans went, wait, Eddie Thawne? Could he possibly turn out to be Eobard Thawne? Professor Zoom? The Reverse Flash? The nemesis of The Flash? It was a misdirect, but it turned out Eddie was the good guy. He was a distant relative of Eobard, who Eobard did appear from the future to kill the Flash, but to make sure that didn't happen and to save Team Flash, Eddie made the ultimate sacrifice at the end of the first season by taking his own life, thus ensuring the evil Eobard Thawne would never be born.
Just so we're clear, after I kill you, I'm going to kill them, and then I'm going to kill your father. I always win.
No, Eddie, stay with me, okay? Stay.
He was wrong. Turns out I'm a hero after all.
You are, Eddie. You are my hero.
That's all I ever wanted to be.
You're a hero.
Well, my guest today, he is a talented actor. You have seen him in The Vampire Diaries, Quantico, and of course, our favorite show, The Flash, as Detective Eddie Thawne. A big Comic Book Central welcome to Rick Cosnett. Rick, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Thank you, Joe. It's great to be here.
Great to have
that
you here.
Amazing introduction. Thank you.
Well, look, you did the work. I mean, that's true. You did all the heavy lifting. I just got to tell people what you did. One thing you do a lot is you die on screen a lot.
Yes, I do. I famously die all the time on screen.
Was this the plan getting into acting? Were you like, I want to be the TV guy that dies?
Well, yeah, I actually did dream of dying on this cartoon called Thunder Sub when I was in grade 3.
Oh, you jumped 3 questions ahead. I was so going to ask you about Thunder Sub.
Oh, really?
Tell me everything about Thunder Sub. Yeah, go for it. No, because I'm like, I loved like that kind of, yeah, because it kind of reminds me, it's like that Japanese animation, right?
Yes.
Like, because I used to watch Star Blazers.
It's got like an anime, like, like tinge to it. Well, it's very anime, really, but it's so epic. It was about, you know, these submarine wars, and there were these two twins, these two young boys, and one of them's name was Rick, and there was this girl, I'm sure her name was April. I mean, I was 8 years old, but the emotions are still fresh in my mind.
Nostalgia.
Which is the most important thing. Yes, totally. And so he was under this like glass dome and they died. The twins died. She was like crying anime tears all over them. And I told everyone at school the next day that I acted in that episode of Thunder Sub.
You told them like you were the voice actor in it.
No, that I like acted in it because we were only like 7. And we lived in
Zimbabwe. Because that's real.
Like, we didn't know how it works. You know? It's all very mysterious.
That's great.
This television was a very mysterious thing, especially in like, what was it, 1980? Yeah, something.
Yeah,
1990.
But I mean, well, sure. Yeah, you guys should have known what cartoons were.
Well, half.
I mean, I knew Mel Blanc was doing Bugs Bunny.
Half the cast believed me. Like maybe like 3 or 4 people believed me.
Okay.
Realistically, and the rest were kind of like, wait a minute.
But that's how good of an actor you were. But isn't that how good of an actor were? You were Solder, right? Yeah. This was Space Carrier Blue Noah. I think that was the original title of Thunder Sub. Yeah, I love these old, like, I love these old Japanese cartoons.
I went and watched the opening credits the other day. I was like, wow. And I was such a little, like, I don't know, a little hussy, a little performer. I was a very theatrical child.
Okay, well, I was wondering about this. Like, where did all this come from? Because does this kind of go back to your parents were involved in acting, right?
Well, they I mean, we were farmers, my mom was a nurse, but we had a tobacco farm. But they used to partake in productions at the Campbell Theatre, which, was this little theater near our hometown.
It's like a little local theater, like a little regional theater that put on plays and things?
Yeah. They used to do like Gilbert and Sullivan's.
Oh, very cool.
My dad was always the lead and my mom was always in the chorus doing the two-step.
Nice.
With Liz Ogilvie.
Nice.
Who was in that one woman who's like in every production. I was obsessed. I was so obsessed. I was mesmerized.
Was it the spectacle of it? Was it the audience feedback? Was it mom and dad doing something that were out of their element?
It was the drum beat. Because I was like 2 or 3 when we used to go. And it was the imagination of what was behind, you know, I completely believed everything that I saw and that the wings were like these other worlds, you know. And so when I finally at a pantomime got called up on stage to participate and I looked into the wings in absolute horror at the brick walls and the pulleys and the ropes, all my dreams were crushed. I thought there were tunnels and. Yeah.
You thought it was another world back there. You thought it was Earth 2 or Earth 3.
Yeah, I did. Totally did. All those, exactly. All those different timelines. Yeah. Or at least just like, you know, like an awesome like tunnel with like cushions that you could slide into the dressing room or something.
Yeah, not a dude sitting there eating a ham sandwich with a, you know, butt crack hanging out or something, you know, pulling curtains or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so what? Okay, but you still embraced it though, right? Like, what? How did you cross that threshold of, oh, there's reality, to, hey, this is pretty cool?
I always wanted to do it. I think I always had a very, I guess, subconscious desire to express what I saw, what I experienced, and also to present, if you will, another a human being. You know, and that's what we sort of try to do. We present life. We look at life, and then we present it with an opinion. You know, so I always had a strong desire to do that. To sort of, you know, it sort of makes sense of life in a weird way.
That's deep for a kid.
Ultimately, doesn't. I mean. I don't think I was thinking that, you know, 6 years old, but okay. In hindsight,
all right. Hindsight. Was this sort of more when you got into, when you moved to Australia and, was it the Queensland University of Technology?
Yeah.
How do you study acting at the Queensland University of Technology?
I know, it's ridiculous. it used to be called the Queensland College of Arts.
Fair enough.
And then it merged, right. But the acting program remained, you know, very prestigious, Joe.
Okay. Fair. No, I saw this. I'm like, what are you trying to like study ridiculous. To be a nerd or like a tech person?
It is
or
ridiculous
what?
That it's part of Queensland University of Technology. it was a very technological acting course. It was actually the least technological. There's four like main drama schools in the country. I mean, there's quite a few, but ours was more like method and very like edgy and kind of, not too traditional. So in Zimbabwe, I did plays. I did stuff at school. I did this massive play when I was like 16. It was all school stuff, but I was, we did this story about Thomas a Becket murder in the cathedral. And then I just was super into it, but we didn't have drama in Zimbabwe. And I was at boarding school. So yeah, by the time I got to Australia, I did drama at school for two years and joined my repertory theater and got an agent and everything. And then I got into acting school when I was 18.
Okay.
And then when I graduated, I moved to Sydney and I lived there for 6 years. And then I moved to the States.
What was your first paid acting gig?
My first paid acting gig, I was the drinks waiter in a film. With these two big Australian stars, and they happened to film, by total coincidence, they filmed my scene at the restaurant that I was working at.
Oh, so like people like actors are always waiters. They're always like, is like, but you had the best.
But
of
I
both
was
worlds.
Actually at my restaurant, but wow. I didn't tell anyone. And they also kept confusing me with the extras. But I was like, no, I'm part of the cast. And they were like, yeah, right.
Cool. Again, that's how good you are. that's how good
yeah,
you are.
Yeah, I know. I put everything into my I think my line was, drink to start, great. And I was like, I just like put all my method into those three words.
but you know you got to start somewhere at that point.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, I've done mad science kids. I was a mad scientist for this company called Mad Science. We used to go around to schools and do shows, and I've done like school musicals for Book Week, and I've done all sorts of acting gigs.
Man, well, okay. So what brought you? And I know the easy joke is an airplane, but what brought you to the States?
Yeah.
To try your hand at acting. Yeah.
I always wanted to come here. But, you know, it was never the right time. I never had enough money, blah, 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 blah. I was waiting. And then I kind of met this life coach and acting teacher, Bernard Hiller, who just was like, it just opened my mind. And I was like, I was kind of stuck in my mind thinking it's not possible. And he just opened it and was kind of like, through all these exercises that continued from drama school.
Well, in what way? Like, what were the exercises? What was?
Well, they come from like the Actors Studio and stuff, like an Eric Morris. It's a very emotional approach, but he coupled that with like this kind of crazy life coaching, where like you basically go like with 100% of yourself towards your dreams, and you change your way of thinking to I can, I will, I am, you know, what do I have to offer? And it was crazy. My whole energy shifted. And then I just started, I was sleeping like 3 hours a night, just organizing my career, realizing that I hadn't, you know, all these things that I hadn't done in the past that I could have been doing.
But did that serve as fuel for you? Regret, it was like, or did you turn that regret into like energy?
Oh yeah, definitely into energy. It was like now or never. You know what I mean? It was like you got to jump now, otherwise you might miss the train, and I would have missed the train. So I moved here to do his class over here, and then ended up staying a little longer, getting a manager. Yeah, it was an insane time in my life because I had no money, and I also had.
See, I hear these stories all the time. People are like, oh, I moved to California, I had no money. Like, okay, tell how much money did you have in the bank?
Minus.
No, like you were
Yeah, oh, I came with $5 in my pocket. I was like,
how do you do that? I hear these stories all the time. I'm like, how does that?
You take
out
an overdraft on your account is what you do. Do you want to technically know?
Oh, you guys are crazy. You guys are crazy.
And then it's like live or die. Well, you know, yeah. I mean, not exactly. I mean, that's a bit dramatic, but it's like sink or swim. You know, like do you want to stay here or don't you?
Yeah, because California. You better work. Cheap. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So I worked really, amazing. Really hard for like 3 years, doing, you know, all I could, classes and.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, take me into some of those classes because, you come to the States and obviously everybody can hear, and if they haven't heard you already, like, you don't sound like Eddie Thawne. But,
yeah.
Like, so yeah. Coming over, and like, you're like, I got to get my American accent, right? Is that
yes,
like, the, okay, so what was that process?
So that was going like, oh, my American accent's great. I've done a lot of work on it. And then people, and then me doing a scene and people going like, was that your American accent? That's the worst thing they could say. Like, just like completely unsure, like if it was or if it wasn't.
Cut a shrimp on the bobby, mate, right? Then, I mean, it probably sounds like when we do Australians, right? Because as a buddy of mine that's Australian, yeah. And he's like, yeah, that's not even close.
Yeah, they're like, do your American accent. They're like, I'm like, I am doing it. Yeah, that was pretty devastating. I had one teacher in particular, John Rosenfeld, who told me, you know, my accent just wasn't good enough. And he said, you have to be American for 6 months. Mm-hmm. Just be American. So I just started being American. And then also I was doing a play in Santa Barbara, but I wasn't Actors Equity, so they weren't paying me enough. So I had to come back to L.A. I had to commute every day. Anyway, Santa Barbara and back to L.A. And I had Bob Corff's acting American accent CD in my car, because this was a few years ago. That was a thing. And so I would repeat these, you know, going all up the PCH and back. Jan prefers yam jam. That was one of my favorites.
That's great.
With, you know, the inflection and the, you know, yeah. It's all in the placement.
But what did you find as the hook? Because you can put a billion CDs in, but that I think you hit on the key was that you have to immerse yourself in the culture. Because once you start hearing because there's so many, like I'm from Pennsylvania originally, and our English is completely different than everybody's English. I mean, we say yins and dan-dan and, you know, and then you go to LA and it's a whole thing, and you go to New York, it's a whole thing, and the South, it's a whole thing. What, and being in that culture, what did you find, what was your hook that you went, that's it, that's what I got to hook onto.
I think it's definitely, it's an organic thing that has to happen where it becomes, you're still a human being while you're talking in a different accent. you know, people can see that you're sort of talking in your natural voice, if you will. And that for me, I still have to practice. I still have a coach, I just did a TV movie and I had to coach with her all the time because it's your muscle memory kind of can fall back, or mine can anyway. So I have to usually, I'll, even when I'm on set, like on The Flash, I would, the night before or definitely the morning of, I would just be American. So in the makeup trailer, like everywhere.
So it stays with you.
Yeah, so that when you're under pressure, you know, you don't have to think about it. Yeah. It's already in place. Yeah, so it's...
No, it's funny because I hear you in interviews. It's interesting.
In Australia...
Oh, go ahead.
In Australia, I had the same... Because I spent 10 years in Australia, by the end of the 10 years, I could sound authentically Australian, you know. Mm-hmm. And that was important there too, because, you know, for roles over there. And then here, it's taken me a while too. And yeah, but as you say, the more time you spend in a place, the more you can, you just every day you pick up on the cultural things and the way people, you know, talk and the melody.
No, it's, well, you just did it. Okay, you just did it there. It's, and I don't know if you meant knowingly did it or not, but it's so funny because I hear you in other interviews and you do, you kind of walk this weird line where you're talking with your accent, your normal voice, but I always hear you slipping into the American accent.
Yes,
almost
so
like every other sentence, you'll slip into a few things, and I'm
it's almost like I'm just—it's almost like I'm subconsciously just making sure.
Yep.
That I can still do it.
No, I've noticed that in many interviews you've had. It's interesting, but that's the actor's life. So just like you never know who
I
you are.
I'm not secure enough to just like completely drop it. I'm always holding a bit.
Yeah. No, that's funny. No, you're holding the look. We talked about how nostalgic you were, so that totally makes sense. Vampire Diaries. A lot of folks know you from Vampire Diaries. Were you into monsters as a kid? What were you grooving on as a kid?
I loved monsters. I loved things like Labyrinth and The Neverending Story, like those kind of monsters. That really kicked my imagination up. I mean, Interview with a Vampire, I found it all really fascinating. I love that stuff. I actually just watched The Neverending Story again a couple of days ago.
Oh, so fantasy,
and I was
so
into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just so wonderfully imaginative, you know, and has all these, they have these themes that I think we really relate to, you know, like... And The Flash has this too, like believing in yourself, you know, coming to terms with who you are. You know, the more hopes and dreams you have, the better your life is. You know, it's, yeah, The Neverending Story really like hit me the other day. I was like, wow, it really spoke to me again.
Well, maybe they'll do a reboot. Maybe you can be in the reboot. That'd be cool. Again, we talk about those deaths, grisly death in that one. Do you have a favorite on-screen demise of yours?
Let me think. Yeah, they were all quite very dramatic.
Yeah.
But yeah,
you never just like
yeah,
go quietly,
like get on a train, like some people, the train from Central City. Bye. I think that's Chantel told me that she left on a train.
She did. And Barry got on the train and had a goodbye and left. And I'm like, that's a cool out. Maybe not as memorable as Eddie's though.
No, not as never. No, I, no, I'm joking. I don't know, but
it's not. No, as a fan, I can tell you.
She, probably The Vampire Diaries. You know, like
it's pretty grisly.
Having Damon put his hand inside me and rip my liver out. I think there's a line that was cut out too, that he looks at my liver and he's like, "Oh, you don't drink much, do you?" And then throws it away, and then proceeds to rip. Throw me on the table and then rip all my guts out.
Ugh.
and then you know, he slits my eyeball open with a scalpel.
Full disclosure, that's not in my wheelhouse, but it is on YouTube, so I prefer your Eddie deaths.
I do,
yeah, but as an actor, you gotta relish those crazy deaths.
Well, I got more lines in with my Eddie death.
You did, yeah. True. Well, let's say
all I could do is scream on The Vampire Diaries.
it's pretty grisly. Yeah, Eddie goes out of here. Let's talk about Eddie Thawne, man. Or should we say Detective Pretty Boy?
Yes.
Were you okay with that nickname?
Of course.
Okay.
All right. Of course. I mean, they put it in the script. Who wouldn't be? I'm happy to be called pretty. I'm like, no, stop. Don't.
No.
Don't call me pretty.
I know.
It's awful.
Well, I know. It's like on shows like this, though, sometimes, you know, you never know how that plays out. But
yeah, because they used to call me Pretty Ricky, all the actors.
Okay.
I think Jesse started that.
Did what came first, Pretty Ricky or Pretty Detective Pretty Boy?
That's actually a really good question. No, I think Detective Pretty Boy was in the pilot. So, yeah, that's right. Iris said to me, I think that was my first day ever, second day. She was like, who's that Detective Pretty Boy or something? And before I'd even come in. Yeah,
that
it
first
was pretty
season.
Cool. Like the, you know, Jeff Johns was They were all there behind set and just like freaking out because it was also their first day, you know. And they were
that
like,
first
"We can't believe these characters are coming to life so beautifully."
Well,
and
that's the thing. The first season is so special because for fans of you know, like myself and the listeners of The Flash, we had the 1990 version, and they did so much, but it was so far ahead of its time. It just wasn't
right.
And then this was the right time, and thank goodness they brought everybody back.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. To bring John back, and I mean, so many people, right? Yeah. Mark,
it's a special show,
and yeah.
All right. Several times you've described Eddie as irritatingly awesome. What did you mean by that?
I meant that to Barry Allen, he, you know, really, really wants to hate him, but he's just so lovely and sweet, and also good at everything. He's one of those people that was good at everything at school and you kind of hated them for it, but then they were also really nice and held no grudges and were friends with everyone. And you just kind of wanted to like, you know, wanted something wrong to something in their life to go wrong. I mean, speak for myself. So yeah, I think that's how I saw him. Was that he was so nice and so so able, you know, and such a like, you know, those people who just seem to have no problem. They were like, you know, they just pleased their dads naturally, you know, because they just played football like they don't want. And they're like, oh, funnily enough, I'm also into finance. Like,
right. Well, it's the star quarterback, but he's also your best friend. He's also wants to be your best bud and hang out with you. And you're like,
yeah,
that doesn't
he's
sound
actually
right.
fun.
Yeah, that
yeah,
doesn't sound
he's
right.
Like, and you kind of want to hang out with him because he's awesome.
No, but I think that's the brilliance of the writing. And you can speak to this as well, is that I think the easy way out would have been to make Eddie a jerk. Because for the comic book fans know that Barry and Iris have to get together. We can't have her with Eddie. But it's like, no, we like him. We actually do want her to end up with him. And when he dies, it's like, oh, that shouldn't happen.
That's to the writer's credit because you know, we did quite a few auditions, and one of the auditions, I guess it's so easy to make Eddie, you know, a bit of an ass because it was kind of fun. So I was kind of playing with that idea that maybe he's a little full of himself or just like unaware that he was full of himself.
Yeah.
But they were like, no, we just want him to be nice. We want him to be super nice.
They wanted you to dial it back a little bit.
And so, yeah. And so I was like, oh, okay, I get it. Yeah. I'll give you so many kinds of nice.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, what was your... Okay, so take us through, like, the audition, that little area there, and then maybe even some of the comic book preps. And I kind of want to get to know, did you know much about the world of The Flash coming into this?
I didn't really. When I got the audition, I was really excited because I loved the name, first of all, and I could see it straight away, even though I hadn't read the comics. I thought, oh, this is classy. I was like, this is really great. It's such a distinct superhero and something that if it's rebooted right, could be so special and such a cool world. And so I immediately fell in love with that. I fell in love with the character as well because it was also just one scene. It was one really long scene that they've written for Eddie while he comes into the precinct and Barry is out of the coma for the first time. And he explains how while Barry was in the coma, him and Iris became really close. He didn't want anything to happen. He's completely oblivious to the fact that, you know, still the fact that Barry's in love with Iris. And was like, you know, we really just got to genuinely know each other. And we have this amazing, genuine love for each other. And, you know, which is cool, of course, would drive Barry insane. But he didn't know that. Eddie was just like kind of pouring his heart out to his mate at the precinct who he had been driving Iris to go see him in the coma and sit there with her, right? Mm-hmm. So they were basically sitting over Barry while he was in the coma, and this romance kind of sparked. So it was wonderful, but I knew that all my ducks were in a row because the casting people loved me. The studio I'd just worked for them on Vampire Diaries just got killed, so I was available. all these things, so I had so much pressure on myself, I think, that I just worked on it like so much. I mean, I knew it like the back of my hand 10,000 different ways. And so by the time I got in there with all the producers, I did it, but I didn't feel like it was quite as electric as I would have wanted it to be. So I went out, nearly went in again and said, can I do it again? But I thought better of it and just went into my car, got onto the 101 highway and burst into tears.
like tears of failure?
Yeah, like full on tears. Yeah.
Oh, like ugly sobbing.
And then, just thought, you know what? It's okay because I'll just keep on trying. And there's always a lesson.
This meant that much to you.
Yeah, it really did.
Wow.
And then I was somewhere and I got all these missed calls from my agent. I was like, that's good. They've probably got another audition and I'm grateful. And then they were like, the hell? They were like, they loved you. You're testing for it on Monday, which means that you're going to the studio. And then if you get through the studio, you go to the network. And that's the final. So I was like, what the hell? And they were like, but the director wants to call you, David Nutter. So I was like, okay, I'm sure he does. So he calls me a couple of days later and he's like, okay, Rick, I just wanted to say, don't do anything differently. Everything you did was absolutely perfect.
Oh, that had to have been, wow, talk about night and day.
Yeah, I know. So then I was like, okay, great. And then I put down the phone. I was like, oh, please, I got this, like, hands down. But still nerve-wracking. And then the studio test, and then it was just me for my character. And there were two other girls for Iris, but it wasn't Candace. So the three of us did our thing and then had a director session, whatever. Anyway, the last day, I went into the room and there they'd flown in this guy from New York who was like, was all American, had this like chestnut hair and was like these muscles. And I was like, oh no. And the year before that, I'd been in the exact same room and came down to the last two for a role on the originals. Mm. And so I just decided in that moment, this guy was so nice to me. And I was just like Eddie Thorne would be, you know. And I was like, he's so Eddie Thorne. And then I was like, I just thought to myself, no, I'm sorry. This is mine.
Mm-hmm.
And had to hold myself together. And then, we didn't find out for a few hours after that. And I had an audition for Constantine that I couldn't go to because my friend said that I was too hyped up.
For the lead of Constantine?
Yeah. Okay. So they moved it to the Monday.
Okay.
And then it was a Friday. But then we found out that I got the part like a couple of hours later when I was halfway up Runyon Canyon.
So let me just back up a second because obviously Constantine, a comic book property as well. So you have the part in hand of Eddie, not the lead, but you have an opportunity to go for a lead for Constantine. So you just say the one's in the hand. I'm going with this.
I mean, got it. Constantine, that was just a preliminary round.
Yeah,
you know,
it just wasn't close enough.
I mean, who knows what would have happened, but
right, you could have lost both.
Well, exactly. Yeah. yeah, I mean, it's smart. Crazy what happens behind smart. The scenes. And you no, find out that so many people are up for so many roles that, yeah.
No, smart move, because the show gets canceled. And look, as we'll get into, we're going to get into something in a little bit. But I think you made the right call. Okay, so did you pour through the comic books?
Yes, oh, absolutely. I still buy them.
So you're like trying to figure out who Eobard is, right?
Well, actually, originally they were gonna go. They were gonna make me Jay Garrick, but we didn't really know yet, so they kept kind of flip flopping a little bit.
Now, back up 1 second.
Yeah,
because that's kind of mind blowing to me. Oh boy, how do I even ask this? So Jay, they were going to make you Jay Garrick. They thought that was going to be a character in season one, or they wanted to make you the John Wesley Shipp thing down the road on Earth 3.
You know, I'm not entirely sure because we never discussed it, but it was on my contract. But but also, they didn't really know. You know, we had these seven people in the core cast, and we were all going to become something, you know,
mm-hmm.
Over time. And they didn't quite know, you know what I mean? They were still kind of working out.
We have characters and we need actors. We'll figure it out later.
Exactly. We'll figure it out. We'll watch it. We'll see what, you know, what people are doing, I guess. I mean, I have no idea but I'm sure they were. You know what I mean? They didn't want to lock things in straight away because we thought we were getting 6 episodes, and then we thought we were getting 13, and then it turned out 18, and then it turned into 22, and then another season, and you know. So I don't know what they were thinking, but often it was like, oh, yeah.
So you're doing homework on everybody at this point.
Yeah. So yeah, I looked, of course, into everyone.
Flash crash course
into Eobard Thorne a lot because, you know, I knew my name was Eddie Thorne, and so I knew I had to be from the Malcolm Thorne, from the Eobard Thorne, from, you know what I mean. I knew that I was kind of tinged with some evil.
Man, you're hitting a lot of stuff here. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so we just didn't know how that was going to play out.
Okay.
But they were excited. I remember Jeff, when I said, I said some line in the pilot, I don't know if it's still in there, good guys and bad guys or something. Mm. And they were like squealing behind the monitor.
Okay. So you didn't know, you thought you might be Eobard. You thought you might not be Eobard. You just didn't know.
Yeah, I just didn't know, and so it was kind of like, let's just get everyone to really love Eddie, and you know, as much as we can. So I mean, there's still a lot of scope, you know, in hopefully seasons to come.
Oh man, don't get too far ahead. I know, look, you're getting there. Look, what police training did you have? Because obviously, you're coming into this. You got to be a convincing cop.
Yeah, I was really concerned about that. And so the director, David Nutter, who'd worked on The Mentalist a lot and a few other shows, had these connections. So he set me up with an ex-police detective who had also done a lot of raids and hardcore stuff in California. And he took me to his friend's backyard and had his friend and his friend's girlfriend hide in the bushes while I came around, you know, showed me how to hold the gun, how to come around corners. And then finally, when you get someone, how to commandingly arrest them,
mm-hmm.
And how to put the cuffs on, how to get them on the ground. And, you know, he just kind of stands there, and the minute he draws his gun at you, you're just like, you just feel, oh my goodness. Like I'm absolutely terrified. This energy, you know, it's quite a thing. I mean, you know, and obviously because he's had years and years and years and years of doing this every day.
Yeah.
So that was important to me. And then another, you know, and so I practiced that. And then another guy took me to a shooting range, which are scarily easy to get into. Didn't even want my ID. And then there was this other guy at the other end, and I'm trying to listen to this gun expert as I'm sort of lamely like trying to shift behind this piece of chipboard in case, you know, this other guy's a complete...
Had you ever fired a gun before?
Mental patient. In Zimbabwe, like a shotgun, you know.
Okay.
But no, never a small gun.
Yeah.
Like a pistol. So, yeah, and then Jesse Martin, who'd played a detective on Law & Order for like 9 years, when we got to rehearsal with David, I had this, like, plastic gun and belt. Jesse just like thought it was the most hilarious, wonderful thing to give me so much shit about it. But I was determined to hold it properly and to, you know,
You pulled it off. You pulled it off. There's a fantastic scene with you and Victor Garber where you know which one I'm talking about.
I love that
right?
sentence.
Yeah. Okay. So
I've always wanted to act with Broadway stars.
But it's such a when you watch the first season, it's such a pivotal moment too, because you're left out in the dark, and then finally you're brought in. You're told Barry's secret identity. You're part of Team Flash. You're in on all this now. And hey, there's superheroes. There's metahumans. There's all this stuff. Woohoo! And then, but you're irrelevant.
Yeah.
Or you think you are. And then there's this great scene with you and Victor Garber. Can you kind of just take me into your mindset into that scene?
It was really interesting because at that stage, you know, we knew that I was going to die. And so it was such a spiritual kind of eerie thing for him to say to me. And we both worked it out, me, Victor, and the director, as we kind of went on. And so it was a wonderful kind of collaborative process of us realizing that, yeah, this is when Eddie realizes that he does find his purpose in a way, and his purpose will be to ultimately sacrifice himself. But his goodness, you know, is kind of sparked. His good nature, his soul kind of finds a purpose, if you will. So it was kind of like, okay, this is going to be an amazing setup for the terrible finality of this person.
It's an unbelievable scene. I want to talk about the death. Look, there seems to be three different schools of thought on how this took place. You're the guy that did it. So I'm finally going to get the answer here. In my interview with John Wesley Shipp, he mentioned his thinking was that it was not intended for Eddie to die in order to take Eobard out of existence. That was his original thought. Here's the quote. He says, "In the beginning of season one, Eddie wasn't supposed to die at the end of the season. No reflection, you know, on Rick or his character. Things change. They rethought things as to who gets to revisit the scene of the crime back in time, et cetera, et cetera. When I talked to Candace Patton, I mentioned that comment to her. She said, well, that's news to me. I thought the finale was the way it was always supposed to be. Andrew Kreisberg, who was the producer on the show at the time, he said, we named him Thawne. We hoped they would suspect he was Eobard Thawne. But we weren't sure how we were going to end the season. It felt like the best thing to do for his character, you know, and then it mentioned, he went on to say about how painful it was, how emotional it was for him to, okay, you're the guy. What happened? Why? Were you supposed to survive season one originally?
Yes.
We're in season we're in season four. It's just, you could tell us now.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what goes on behind the scenes.
All right.
But yes, we were all like signed on as regulars for like, you know, I guess they get you to sign like a 6-year contract.
Yeah.
So that was the intention, but then I don't know how, you know, or what happened exactly. I wish I did know, but in a way, maybe I don't.
There wasn't any issue with you, or you wanted out of the show, or they were unhappy. There wasn't anything like that, right?
No. What I think happened was, you know, it's good to kill someone at the end of season one.
And why not, you know, Rick Cosman? Yeah.
And I was really in the wrong place because first of all, we had find out that find out that there's metahumans. So the police precinct started to become a little superfluous, and the action was more at Star Labs, where I, you know, everyone has a little connection to it, but I didn't have any connection to it really. And then also I was the third wheel in the main romantic relationship. And so, you know, if you'd looked at all the characters and pointed to one who was going to die, unfortunately, I think it just happened to be me. But they were very good about it, you know, and they, Andrew sat me down 2 months before, 2 months before the finale, and said, there's no easy way to say this, but we're killing Eddie. And he was very upset, you know, as was Greg. And, but they were super nice to me, and I was very accepting, that, you know, this was, my life was taking a different turn as well as my character's life. And we were all very, very sad.
Did the rest of the cast know at that point?
There were a lot of tears.
Okay. So they
knew. Yeah. With all of us. Okay. I think Jesse and Grant found out, and then I sort of, yeah, it was like, well, I'll call Candace and call Carlos and Danielle. So it was full on. It was a full on time. It was kind of whoa. But at the same time, you know what I mean? I was actually very mature about it. I was very, of course I was upset, but I was also kind of like, oh, okay, this is, you know, this is pushing me onto new things.
Okay, fair. No, so, I wanted to get the story straight from
the lowdown.
I've heard it from peripheral, you know, cast members and things like that, but I wanted to get it straight from you. So it's an amazing scene, and boy, it took us all by surprise. I asked Michelle Harrison this a few weeks ago to tell us something about Grant Gustin we don't know. Tell us something about Candace Patton we don't know.
She's extremely kind.
We know that.
I know. Maybe you do know that.
We know that.
I'm like, oh, you don't know that she's actually a good person.
she's. All, I thought she was horrific. Yeah, no. Tell us something we don't know about Candace.
I just had coffee with her last weekend. On Saturday, we had brunch, actually. Something you don't know about Candace. I don't know. She's pretty amazing. I mean, you know all the amazing things about her. So she really is a great friend of mine.
You all love each other, I
and,
know.
She has some crazy skill
that we don't know about, or does she, like, what does she do on set?
Yeah,
that, like,
she used to be a Texan cheerleader in Dallas. That's always how I see her now.
Like, does she do a cheer on set?
I've seen her do something, yeah.
There we go.
Sure, because everyone's dancing all
That's
the time.
That's what I need.
And she's from Dallas, and she does not mess around.
no, that's good. That's good. That's what we want to know.
Yeah, she's got a very she's got an amazing sassy side to her too, like in a great way. She's very funny. Very funny.
Okay, here's what I love about The Flash. They bring characters back. So you came back a couple times as Eddie. You came back as Eddie, actually, in Flashback, Season 2, Episode 17. You also came back as the Speed Force
yep.
Eddie. What was it like coming back after? Like, did you know you were coming back, or was
that
a surprise
bizarre.
To you?
Well, no, I found out, like, beginning of December for, like, end of January. And that was completely bizarre because it was life. Well, all the times I've been back was, like, you know, art mirroring life. It was like a mirror of what was happening in the story. Me coming back to the same sets with the same people, but everything just being a little bit different. And so they'd done the police precinct, but there was nothing on any of the desks. You know, it was like this twilight zone, and there was a picture of me on the fallen, you know, heroes wall. That they had to dig it out of the drawer or something. It was like, where's the picture of my cat? We had this hilarious picture of my cat on my desk. And Yeah, and it was all misty. It was all like foggy, and and it was grand. Like we'd all like kind of grown and changed, but we were coming back to that same time point in time. You know, it was absolutely bizarre and completely profound. And Grant was like, your acting's like changed. I don't know, you're just like more mature. I was like, stop it, tell me more. it was beautiful. It was crazy.
You mentioned in a recent interview that you'd like to return to The Flash as a villain. Were you aware that there was a theory for a while that you were Savitar?
Yes. Yeah, I know. Finally, someday I'm going to come out. Everyone's like, oh my God, he's the Reverse Flash. Oh my God, he's Savitar.
Uh-huh.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Okay. That was not, so, I mean, we know that didn't happen, but there was that. May I ask you this, and I don't know if you can tell me the answer to this. At end of season one, maybe it was the first episode of season two, you're sucked into the singularity.
Yes.
You're
the
wearing
wormhole, if you will.
Yeah, you're wearing something, right?
Yeah.
What are you wearing?
Well, it's actually, I know a lot of people thought it was a ring.
Right, it's not.
It's not. It's actually the insignia crest, the Thorn family crest.
Right. It's a necklace, right?
It's a necklace. And it's actually, I wore it the whole season as well.
Okay, cool. Cool.
Yeah, so I know there's been a lot of meaning attached to that. So
yeah, is it a talisman?
Hopefully it'll come out, you know, later on.
Yeah. Well, you opened the door. I'm going to walk through it. You mentioned Malcolm.
Yeah.
You read up on him, right? You read up?
Yeah, yeah.
What did you learn about Malcolm?
Malcolm is the one who becomes Cobalt Blue, if I'm not mistaken.
No, you're not mistaken.
He seems really in line with, you know, my sort of character. I mean, there's a lot of potential, I suppose. I know that that's the actual, it's sometimes hard to, sift through like what's fan fiction or what's, written by DC.
Sure.
But yeah, that's the DC storyline.
Sure, it is.
Which is really, really interesting.
What did you and Candace talk about over coffee?
we just talked about everyone.
I bet you did.
We talked, I got the lowdown on what's happening on set.
Sure,
yeah,
sure you did.
And I didn't know she lived with Keenan. She's good friends with Keenan and Katie Lotz. They became really close.
Everybody's getting along.
Yeah. It's,
all right, cool.
Everyone's getting along though,
I'm not going to push you anymore.
I'm serious.
No. We'd love to see you come back as Cobalt Blue. That would be very cool. So I know you can't say anything. You guys are, you guys have signed NDAs all the way to
totally. But also, I wish other cast members knew.
Yeah.
I would know. So I know the writers don't tell them.
Right. I know they don't tell because they'll spill it. What storyline would you write? Would you
costume people? They know everything.
That's what Ship said. That's when he found out about stuff. Yeah, when they were getting the costumes. That's exactly
yeah, casually like ask a few questions.
Well, you're writing now. what storyline would you write for your ultimate return to the Flash? Would you villain? Is that where you want to go?
Well, I would like to be a slower burn than that, but. There's so many different opportunities. I don't want to ruin saying something.
Nope, but, I totally get that. That's let's talk about something.
But
you
I
are,
think.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go I think ahead. Reestablishing the relationships would be fun, and then going somewhere crazy.
Okay, let's talk about something you have produced: The Letter Carrier, co-directed with your Flash castmate Jesse L. Martin, music by Carlos Valdez. Man, my goodness. When can we expect the three of you to hit the road as an a cappella group?
Oh my God, this summer, I hope. I mean, no, I wish. They're just two of my closest people, and it would be so amazing because they just both have such great voices. I mean, I really just do the bass, you know. I'm just kind of the, like, the anchor. And just, like, happy to be a part of it.
This is part of the short film, right? This is, there's music, it's music driven.
There's,
tell us what we need to know about The Letter Carrier.
It's basically a fairy tale folklore story written by Jesse L. Martin. It's set in 1860 in the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia. And it's a story basically about how a mother protects her family from the outside world, if you will. That's all I'm going to give away. But it's all done a cappella, and it's all done with only using natural sounds. So there's no fake soundtrack. And it was really a fascinating experience. Carlos Valdez is a musical prodigy, like genius. And he helped us as much as he could. But yeah, I mean, it turned out really well. But yeah, it was an amazing process. Like it was so much work, more work than I ever thought for a 15-minute film.
Well, I know, but how long did you get to shoot? Because were you working on this while you were working on The Flash, or was it?
Yeah, but we started filming like a week after we wrapped season one.
Okay.
Which was also a lovely way to end my character's demise.
go back to work.
Because most of the Flash crew was working on our film. And it was on the production designer's property. We even had the caterers there because they own a farm close to there. And yeah, it was really awesome in these woods, in kind of in the middle of nowhere, for these three amazing sunny days, in which you hardly ever get in Canada. So it was just magical. And then the fourth day it rained.
That wasn't the total shoot, was it? 3 days?
Four days.
Are you kidding me? You shot this in 4 days?
Yeah. I mean, it's only 15 minutes.
Still. Yeah, that's...
It had its huge challenges because not only were we recording the music live, but you have to, you know, you've got to do it over and over and over again. But for editing purposes, you have to... So yeah, we had a very elaborate, like, earwigs in people's ears so they could hear each other when they were in different spaces. But, you know, we called in so many favors and everyone just was so enthusiastic and we had an embarrassment of riches, really. And we raised a lot of money on Kickstarter, so we were able to do the things we wanted to do. So we're going to actually release it in a few weeks.
Okay, that was what I wanted to ask. How do we see this? Because I know you're shopping it to film festivals. You've been doing this. You've been winning awards.
Yeah, we got around to about 16 to 20 festivals, right. And we're getting the last of our Kickstarter backer rewards out to people. So that's the DVDs, and they are about to be mailed. We had to all sign them, so it was a lot of back and forth.
Yeah.
But they're looking amazing. So
this is Amazon though? Like, can we? Because I know
No, we're just gonna release it online for free.
Okay, this is thelettercarrier.squarespace.com.
There it is, Joe. Thank you.
And that's where we go. So we're going to get it there?
Yeah. So we haven't actually, the final decision hasn't been made, but I think we're going to release it on there and on YouTube. It'll be on there. It's going to be YouTube link anyway.
Oh, this is going to be great.
So, yeah.
Okay. So your best buddy, you're co-directing with your best buddy. I saw in one interview you mentioned about, because we know you guys love each other. But how do you resolve disputes? Because you mentioned, quote unquote, when we clash, when you're co-directing, how do you make sure that you both get to the vision you need to get to?
It happens quite organically and seamlessly. We never clash. We never really clash. It's more of a collaborative discussion. So it'll be like, what about this? I don't think that. We both tend to kind of yin and yang each other in a way that we both have such crazily different perspectives, but we have the same taste. So, you know, I'm a white colonial from Zimbabwe. He is a black African-American. So you know, we have this kind of cool perspective on things that I hopefully is going to continue into our next project, which is this film that I'm wanting to do in Zimbabwe.
Possibly a feature?
So, yeah.
Nice. Oh, this is, you know, beautiful friendship.
Yeah, exactly.
The beginning of a beautiful friendship here.
And that was, you know, one of the most special things that I got from The Flash is all these, you know, is a handful of really great people, as well as, you know, of course, the story and all the rest of it. But yeah,
that's fantastic. So we're going to follow you on social media. I'll put the links to your, you're on Twitter.
Yep.
And yeah, are you on Facebook?
At Rick Cosnett. Yep. Instagram. At Rick Cosnett.
All that. So Rick, I'm sure we're going to be seeing you back in the world of The Flash in some form or fashion. Cobalt Blue. Cobalt Blue. Until then, we are looking forward to these other projects. Maybe see you at a convention coming up. Man, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today on Comic Book Central.
Thank you, Joe. You're awesome. Cheers.
It was interesting that Rick was almost Jay Garrick. He was almost Constantine. Look, you never know how these things turn out, but look, let's just hope he does return as Cobalt Blue. That would be a look. They're bringing all these characters in. He would make an amazing big bad for season 5. That would be very cool. Look, they've certainly set things up that way. It'd be very cool if it happens, and it seems like it very well could happen, so who knows. But if it does happen, I'm sure you'll hear about it on his social media pages. I'm going to put the links to those in the show notes for this episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net, and the show's page on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com. Again, my thanks to Rick Cosnett for dropping by today and chatting about The Flash and so many cool things. All right, folks, like The Reverse Flash kicking into high gear, I'm going to speed on out of here. But I shall return in a flash, because next week on Comic Book Central, Hail Hydra. Man, it is time to get all evil up here in the lair as I spend some time with the man who menaced Agent Carter and the Howling Commandos at the time of Captain America's origin. And he took on the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. How was he able to do that? We will find out when actor Reed Diamond stops by to talk about his role on the TV series Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. as Daniel Whitehall, a.k.a. the evil Dr. Werner Reinhardt. That is what's headed your way next week. Until then, remember, the future is yours to create, so keep creating a good one. Keep reading those comics. And thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
Sing out loud, my brothers and sisters. Don't you carry me away. Flowers are blooming on the mountainside. Cool breeze blowing where the hummingbirds fly. Picking all the posies to put in her hair. The peaches that were sweetest were the ones she shared. Green grass growing on the great big hill. Peach pie cooling in the windowsill. Sister singing sweetly about Judgment Day. Bringing you a letter just to carry you away. Don't carry me away.
Don't carry me away.
Don't carry me away.
Carry me away.
Sing out loud, my brothers and sisters, don't you carry me away.